All right, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's July 22nd, 2015. And two talks ago, I explored with you why we practice, right? And we practice for ourselves, but we can also have it be real for us, so we practice for others. And the epitome of that in the Buddhist tradition is the notion of the bodhisattva, who, out of great compassion for all beings, develops oneself for the sake of others, even postponing ultimate liberation. And in the Buddhist cosmology, in some sense, ultimately not coming back anymore to help people until everybody's enlightened. You know, the bodhisattva vow, an aspect of it is, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to enlighten them all. Right? So why do we practice? For our own sake, certainly, but also for the sake of others, including in very practical ways, that, you know, we've maybe become less cranky and easier to live with, more patient, wiser, okay? Last time we met, I talked about what we practice. And there was a lot of stuff in that talk, so I want to quickly recap it and then focus on one aspect of it and see what you think. I pointed out that the Buddha's teaching is that suffering comes from seeking happiness where it cannot be found. It's not just doomed to seek happiness where it cannot be found, but it's also stressful, contracted, driven, anxiety-provoking, frustration-creating, and so forth. And so where do we search for happiness where it cannot be found? We search for it out in material conditions of various kinds, possessions, activities, relationships, events. There's certainly a place for seeking what is prosperous or helpful or wholesome or enjoyable. But if we think that those material events or conditions are a basis for lasting, profound happiness and contentment and inner peace, the Buddha's argument is that you can't find it there. And that's certainly been my experience as well. Certainly not a kind of profound inner peace and fulfillment. Also, we tend to seek for happiness more intimately in our experiences of things. In other words, we tend to try to have the really groovy experiences and then to keep them. But as soon as we try to hold on to experiences which are inherently transient, and also insubstantial, as soon as we try to hold on to them, stabilize them, thingify them, whatever was enjoyable and wholesome and beautiful, in that moment, kind of freezes, twitches, and boom, suffering. Like that. So that's the Buddha's view, including subtle spiritual-type experiences, blissful experiences, meditative attainments. As soon as we try to make the experience the basis for our lasting happiness, we don't find lasting happiness, and in fact, the attempt to make the experiment, or the experience rather, a basis of lasting happiness, why can't I experience the bliss I felt the last time I meditated, say, we start suffering again. Now, the good news is that it's not just a matter of stopping what isn't working. Actually, there's a really good alternative, which is embedded at bottom in the third noble truth, the possibility of not doing the searching and clinging and, in a word, craving that is the fundamental essence and seed continually of those doomed and suffering-saturated strategies for happiness. The Buddha says, well, guess what? Seeking happiness, lasting, true, profound fulfillment in things that change is doomed, but there are some things that don't change. And by opening to and abiding increasingly as and becoming increasingly accessible to and lived by that which isn't changing, there we have an opportunity for a lasting basis of true happiness. That's what I talked about last time with some flourishes. And as a bit of a quotation here, he says, the Buddha, as best our guess, you know, or something close to what he said, the entire world is in flames. And he's especially talking about the world of the mind, our own experience. It's in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. He's talking about change. Okay? And he's using the metaphor common of the time of fire rituals. You know, flames are changing, and flames are produced by fuel. So you think of the fuel for the ordinary life of subtle and gross suffering. Not as the entirety of the life, but a significant aspect of it that we're grappling with. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the noble ones who are awakened, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. So last week I talked about various ways to engage the second kind of major aspect of practice. One major aspect is to disentangle ourselves increasingly from those doomed strategies that also create a lot of suffering. We purify the mind, we develop greater sort of moral self-restraint in healthy ways, we cultivate wholesome factors of mind and heart, we internalize over time deeper and deeper feelings of our core needs met, so we're less tipped into drivenness in various ways, we're less controlled by underlying feelings of deficit or disturbance that drive those engines of seeking, at bottom fear, frustration, or heartache, in terms of our needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. That's an important part of practice. It's kind of the long, slow slog, you know, clearing that stuff away. And also, in addition to that process of gradual cultivation, we seek to open to and have more and more moments of sudden awakening, where we have a sense of, if only for a flash of 3/4 of a second, a sense of, or an intuition of, or an intimation of, or a resting as, that which isn't changing. And I use the metaphor of, to put it a certain way, if the ordinary psyche is like an opaque cloth, one moment of awakening at a time, we poke pinholes in that cloth. So increasingly, the light that's always already there can shine through, and we become increasingly lacy and foamy and accessible. And I think that's a way to operationalize really what it's like to hang around people who are very, very far along the path. You really feel like they're a minimally translucent, you know, window whoosh, for light that's shining through. Okay? But there's this other aspect of practice, as I said, you know, sudden awakening, or as the Tibetan proverb has it, sudden awakening, moments of awakening, instants of awakening many times a day. Okay? So now I'd like to just talk about one of the major experiential indicators of that which is not so conditioned, that which is unconditioned, that which is not vibrating, not burning, not changing, upon which we can truly take our stand. And one of the main attributes of that quality is stillness. It's unchanging. It's still. Right? So I want to talk about stillness tonight. I think, to simplify, there are four kinds of stillness. And I want to contextualize this by starting with an observation about reverse engineering enlightened mind, what seem to be some of the major qualities of people who are saints and sages, not theologians theorizing away, but people who really embody practice. Like, what are they like, you know? Or what are you like in that moment when, boom, you just really feel like, wow, I'm kind of close to there. Or maybe I'm really there, you know? As soon as you try to hold on to there, you're no longer there, right? But like, well, what are some of the qualities? I just offer these in a frame in which, as we rest our minds upon that which we aspire to be, as we rest our minds upon that which calls us, our minds increasingly take that shape. So much of what meditation is a resting our minds upon that which we most wisely long to be. You know, and by resting our mind upon that, our mind, as the Buddha puts it, gradually takes its shape from what we rest upon, what it rests upon. Or in the language of modern neuroscience, experience-dependent neuroplasticity, those neurons that are really firing together are really going to be wiring together as well. It's a paraphrase of the famous saying. So what are some of those attributes we rest our minds upon as an entry into this discussion of stillness? I think one of those attributes is what might be called nowness, a sense of being radically at the leading edge of now, just right now, continually, right? They seem to be totally in the now. Whether it's Eckhart Tolle really writing very clearly about that, or other people, or another quotation I could offer from the workshop I did on Sunday, right now. So in our practice, we cultivate the capacity to be now, to be here now, as Ram Dass put it. Okay? Second attribute of allness. There's a sense that these people talk about of just as, you know, the joke has it, what did the Dalai Lama say to the hot dog vendor? Please. Make me one with everything, right? You know that joke. If you haven't heard it before, it's kind of cool, right? Or there's another joke. What did the Dalai Lama say when he got this big box for his birthday present? Oh, what I always wanted, nothing. So anyway, allness, that sense of being one with everything, one with one's own mind in terms of the level of experience, phenomenology, and also one with the whole natural world, and one with reality altogether. One with society, one with culture, non-dual, undifferentiated, your pain is my pain, and so forth, okay, allness. So we have nowness and allness. And a third major attribute is non-craving, just equanimity in a word. Engaged with life, but without chasing after what's pleasant or resisting or fighting with what's unpleasant, clinging to what's heartfelt, or wanting what's neutral to hurry up and become enjoyable. Just at peace, not undisturbed. You know, walking evenly over uneven ground, as the saying has it. Equanimity. These people feel really just equanimous. They feel sorrow when things happen to their loved ones. They pull their hand back from burning stoves. They enjoy the taste of a raisin in their mouth for 5 or 10 minutes, but they're not disturbed at all about it. They're engaging life on the basis of a prior sense of fullness and balance rather than deficit and disturbance. Okay. Third quality, they seem very loving. You know, I had a friend who was a monk in Asia for 9 years, and I asked him once about enlightened beings he met, and you know, he said, well, and I asked him their qualities, he said, well, there were one thing, you know, really stood out, they were always the same. And I went, what do you mean? And these are people who are far along, maybe all the way cooked. He said, well, if you were nice to them, they really loved you. If you were mean to them, they really loved you. They might ask you to leave the temple because you're growing dope in the jungle above it and you're not supposed to do that, you know, in the monastery system in Thailand, let's say. But they still loved you. Their love was undisturbed, you know, and you feel that. You feel people, and you read the saints and sages in history, Jesus, you know, people who talk about love as a profound practice. Okay? And then also they seem to be really happy. There's this a deep happiness. You know, the Buddha was called the happy one. It's not a conventional, oh boy, I got a promotion happiness, which is got nice happiness, but it seems like a great, wonderful contentment, bliss that's unshakable. Right? In those attributes, and you can really feel it around allness, stillness, allness, nowness, nowness, allness, is a kind of stillness. You feel like you're talking with them and they're processing the changing, but there's something in them that's rested in stillness. As if they're kind of, you know, in stillness, receiving change. You know, receiving change in stillness. They're kind of rested in stillness as things happen, right? There's that quality about them. And so I want to explore that quality of stillness with you. I think there are four kinds of stillness, and we can look for stillness and rest our minds more and more on stillness in these four kinds of ways. And see if this connects with you. The first kind I think of as sort of external or ordinary stillness. Little things that you go, huh? Like, you know, if you throw a ball up, it goes up, and then at a certain point, it stops moving either up or down. It's at that point of perfect stillness at the top of its trajectory. There is that instant where it's not moving up or down. It's as if that's a kind of stillness. Or I'm thinking of the conductor who raises his or her hand and gets ready, the whole hall hushes, and then there's the downbeat. It's that moment. Or again, sound, thinking of John Cage's line, I think to paraphrase, he says, the heart of music is the silence between the notes. Or you can feel that again in motion. There's like anticipation, you know, that Rocky Horror Picture Show clip there. You know, there's that sense of stillness. We can see it around ourselves. Maybe you feel it, you know, like you go outside and you look up the stars, and there's almost a sense of the vastness of the universe as still. You know, that inky blackness, stillness there. Something, many opportunities for stillness in ordinary life. The pond, you see the pond, it's just perfectly flat. Like, wow. Right? There are probably lots of other examples as well. Ordinary, you know, stillness. A second kind of stillness to draw your attention to is psychological. Like, to use an example from Ajahn Sumedho, one of the primary teachers in the Western Theravadan tradition that I primarily, I guess, am trained in. He says, notice the space between thoughts. And one way to do that is to kind of pause and then deliberately create a thought, like, you know, zebras are striped, or, you know, I am enlightened, could do that one. He recommends that one. Or I am not enlightened, he recommends that one as well. Just a thought, you create a thought. And notice that first quarter second prior to the thought and right after the thought. It's as if you start to notice the grout between the tiles of mental events, mental objects. But got the idea of the metaphor? Grout, that little space between the tiles. It's like, and it's a kind of space of stillness. It's ready to represent the next thought, the next tile of mind objects, sounds or sights or thoughts or feelings or sensations and so forth, but it's not yet doing so. It's like, by the way, another stillness in the first category is that space between the inhalation and the exhalation, or exhalation and inhalation. That's another, like, it's really interesting. It's stillness, okay? So now, thoughts, there's that space. Or more generally, people talk about the space of awareness. Especially as the mind gets quieter, there's a sense that awareness is a still field. It's a stable, unchanging, therefore still, field through which experiences move. Or, you know, we're aware of awareness, a space in which what we're aware of arises and passes away. Or a little bit like the surface of a TV screen that can represent anything, but the surface itself is always just the surface of the TV set. So people talk about awareness as a kind of, you know, stillness. Okay, these are just places to look, and we're going deeper and deeper now. Also, as we become increasingly tranquil, as I was encouraging in the meditation suggestions here, it's as we start sometimes when things are really getting quiet, where there's a stable stillness of mind. The mind is a stable quiet. It's like just, you're right here, you're right there, the body's quite relaxed. Sometimes there's a sense of a kind of ka-thunk, a sort of settling into it, a zoom, you're there. Maybe there lasts only for a few seconds, you know, maybe there lasts longer and longer, especially as you're maybe doing a day of practice or a week of practice, you drop into it faster. Kathunk. Tranquility. In one of the seven factors of awakening in the Buddhist system. To be valued, according to the Buddha. Okay, so far? So those are the first two places to look. I think a third kind of stillness, and again, this is what is recommended to us by the great teachers, certainly in the Buddhist tradition, is the nature of things. This can become quite conceptual, and it's okay in the beginning, but increasingly we want to move out of conceptualizing about it, and that conceptualizing is another mental object subject to change, and therefore an unreliable basis for happiness. You know, the map is not the territory. The menu is not the meal. We study the menu, we study the recipe, but ultimately, wordlessly, we experience the meal. We experience the nature of things. But especially in Tibetan Buddhism, they really do, a great job of describing the nature of things. So if you think of it, things change, but their nature doesn't change. Right? The contents of mind are continually changing, but mind as a totality doesn't change. Mind as mind doesn't change. The empty nature of mind altogether and the empty nature of any mental object, empty in the technical sense, not as a void or non-existence, but rather the foaminess, the interdependentness of any experience, certainly. Its insubstantial qualities. Its non-absolute self-existence. It arises dependently and passes away. Right? That quality, that nature of any mental object, any sound, any sight, any thought, any feeling, any desire, as well as that nature of mind as a whole, is unchanging. And what happens is that, again, it's kind of tricky, but it's as if you look over your shoulder for about a third of a second and you like feel, you recognize, you open into kind of like the nature of things. And in that moment, you kind of like, if you watch it, if you're happening, you disengage from the ordinary pursuit of pleasure and happiness and thus suffering, which arises, and you're popped out of that business. And then you start conceptualizing about what just happened. You're no longer in it, right? But that's okay. But over time, more and more, you just have this feeling in your body of being the nature of things rather than being things themselves. Right? You can understand it logically, right? Things change, but their nature doesn't change, you know? And in terms of material reality, planets move, you know, water drips, things happen, but allness altogether doesn't change. Right? Okay. So it's an exploration, but let's go all the way. Or let's have a roadmap. Maybe we're not that far up that trail, but we have a feeling. This is a well-developed roadmap by people who really have gone a long way up that trail. And this is how they talk about it. Okay? And then the fourth kind of stillness, people experience as just outside the frame, as outside the ordinary frame. Something infinite, something perhaps transcendental, something beyond the nature of mind and matter, which I've talked about so far, been in the natural frame so far. Now the fourth kind of stillness is outside the natural frame. It may not be relevant to you. If it is, it's kind of a real, I think, useful opportunity to feel into or listen for or get a sense of what is eternal. What's eternal is unchanging and therefore still, right? What is boundless, without bounds that arise conditioned? What is unconditioned? Right? The Buddha speaks to that a lot. That which is not yet conditioned and therefore changing, and therefore an unreliable basis for lasting happiness. Whatever is conditioned, in his view, is not a proper basis to rest in for our lasting happiness. Okay. So I have two quotes I want to offer here and then see what you make of all this. Okay. For some people, by the way, they have a sense of stillness in a practice that's clearly transcendentally oriented, if that's meaningful to them. And to be clear with you, I'm a transcendentalist, it's meaningful for me, but I'm not trying to persuade you of that. You know, I'm perfectly comfortable staying inside the natural frame of the first three places to look for stillness. By the time you get to the third one, you're definitely into some deep stuff still inside the natural frame of mind and matter. Okay? A couple quotes and then hear from you. So, one quote is from Buddhadharma. The born and therefore conditioned, caused to come into being. The born come to be produced. The made, the conditioned, the transient, conjoined with decay and death. A nest of disease, perishable. Sprung from nutriment, from being fueled and fed, and craving's cord, that is not fit to take delight in.
What's the last word? Not to take
that is not fit to take delight in, that which is conditioned and changing. The escape from that, the peaceful, beyond reasoning, everlasting, the not born, the unproduced, the sorrowless state that is void of stain, the cessation of states linked to suffering, the stilling of the conditioned, bliss. Pointing to what is really outside, I think, the natural frame of mind and matter, to what is prior to, if that's meaningful, or under in some sense, outside the frame of in some sense, certainly beyond the language of what is inside the frame of mind and matter, mystery perhaps. And as Thomas Merton, the Christian monk and student of Buddhism, says, be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Whose silence are you? And to paraphrase, whose stillness are you? That's the fourth place to look for stillness. Okay. How do you feel about all this? Any comments or questions, personal shares, whatever you like. Two over here, yeah.
Last week you were talking about, and I think you said it before, breathing in with your whole body, taking a breath. And I experienced that last week. It was kind of like a magic, like a magic trick.
Yeah.
And it was my way of, my words for it were also experiencing the allness of things. So.
I'm glad.
Thank you for that. But also, is that, I was curious, is that a common experience or is that the experience you're talking about?
Yeah. I think that, so to paraphrase for the recording in part, a person can do practices, including those I suggest, in which we open into allness in part by opening to the whole of our experience, starting the sensations of breathing, and then the body as a whole. Then the way I do it is incorporating sounds and sights, and then all of experience, and then awareness. So abiding as mind as a whole, okay, progressively, as a practice, let's say. And people who do that, I think first, they do often go out into that allness sense, I do, and it's become increasingly stable. And I do that in part based on studies on the brain that show that one way to activate networks on the sides of the brain that tend to pull us out of the conventional strategies and the doomed and suffering saturated strategies for happiness centered in the midline regions of the brain, of the cortex, that if we go into those whole body experiences or other forms of gestalt awareness, being like going out into nature, taking nature visually as a whole, right? Whatever it is, those tend to strengthen, to stimulate and therefore strengthen those lateral networks. Now, I don't think of that as ultimate enlightenment, but it's like it. It's like a piece of it. And in part, we rest our minds on what's like fully enlightened, God realized, if you will, or inside the natural frame, you know, enlightenment as we conceive of it. We rest our minds increasingly on that which is like the ultimate. You know? And then I think over time we become that way. We start having intimations of what is unconditioned in our minds, inside the natural frame, mind and matter, in part because it gives us intuitions of felt embodied intuitions of, in my view, ultimate unconditionality in which all of material reality arises. It's not the same as the effectively unconditioned nature of awareness. It's not the same as ultimate transcendental unconditionality, but it's like it because it's not effectively unconditioned. So by radically experiencing what's unconditioned in mind, that gives us a sense of what perhaps you decide for yourself is ultimately unconditioned. And hopefully that makes sense, I don't know. But that to me explains a lot why we do these practices that are clearly inside the frame of mind and matter, inside the natural frame, and yet they tend to give people intimations of ultimate transcendental matters. But along the way, here's what I think is useful. You know, there is a path. It starts in the swamps and the dusty fields, right? And periodically, we're suddenly transported to the top of Mount Everest, where sudden awakening. And then, darn, we find ourselves slogging through the mud again. And after a while, we get further and further along the way. You know, and we see people further along. They shout back to us, it's what it's like up here, or they leave messages in a bottle for us, they send it back to us, and we move along the way. So we want to be honest about wherever we are in our own path, right, including our moments of being teleported to the top of Mount Everest, the ultimate, let's say. But what we most need to know is what's our next step, right, without getting too fascinated with ultimate matters. Okay, yeah. Yeah, really.
You kind of answered that.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean, it just seems like all religions, there's a built-in rigor that's required.
Yeah.
You know, there's a path.
I'm so glad.
People don't want to take that path. Yeah.
Did you want to say more about that? I kind of stepped on that sentence there.
Well, we all, some of us, back in the 60s, LSD and
sure.
And stuff.
Yeah.
We thought we got there.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. Okay, it's really great you bring that up. So first, to quote Gurdjieff, he says drugs are like telescopes. They show you what's possible, but then you've got to get there on your own, right? And I think in some ways, you know, meditation or retreats or being blown out and kind of like inducted into a place by a guru or some experience, right? Those are like telescopes that show us what's possible. But then to quote Samuel Bondra, we need to wake down, not just wake up. We need to embody, backfill, build an infrastructure, bring it into the real, you know. So I think there's that part to it. And if we have a history of practice in which we've cleared some of the stones out of the garden of our mind and fertilized it, then when those moments land, ba-boom, they really land on fertile soil. You can see people who have had amazing experiences who are just not prepared for them, and they became psychotic as a result. And then you can see people who, after a fair amount of cultivation and purification, they had similar experiences, but the ground was prepared for them, that part. But to put those two pieces together, and this is, I think, an important point, I think it's really powerful to practice in the first three levels with a strong, recurring sense of and view about the fourth. In other words, engage the way I divide it a little bit, disentangle from the conventional strategy as one part of your practice while becoming increasingly accessible to what's not that, to unconditional love, however you conceive it, to becoming increasingly a vehicle for presence as you conceive it, having more and more of a lighthearted dignity, carefree dignity, as Sokni Rinpoche describes it, as a way of being, as a resting state, okay? And keep that in mind as we grind through whatever processes of cultivation are useful to us. And I do find that an opening over time increasingly to stillness is really, really helpful in that regard. Yeah, couple more?
Yeah, could you give one or two examples, concrete examples of something conditioned and something unconditioned?
Yeah.
That's still a little fuzzy for me.
Right. Well, to do it in a simple sense, imagine a chalkboard that's empty. Okay? Now, in some broader sense, that chalkboard itself is conditioned. It was built. Right? People, other sources, trees grew to form the wood of the frame. People cut those trees down. People formed that frame. Products were developed to lay out there. The chalkboard was conditioned. But once you've got a chalkboard that's empty, it's effectively unconditioned. It can represent anything. As soon as you start writing on it, what is forming there is conditioned. All right? So what's forming is conditioned in a space of effective unconditionality. Think about the surface of a river that's in a sense chaotic. Okay, it's just coming along, right? And no patterns are at all stable on the surface of that river. The broadest sense is like the chalkboard, the river is conditioned, right? Rain fell up in the mountains, the channel was formed over eons, all that stuff, okay? But inside that frame, the surface of the river is in effect noisy, it's unconditioned, it's randomized. But if an eddy forms in that stream, or a standing wave forms around a large boulder in the stream, that shape, that patterning, is conditioned. Same in the mind. If awareness is like the chalkboard, right? Once you've got it, yeah, awareness is conditioned, but inside the frame of awareness, which is what we experience, it's effectively unconditioned. So, I was doing it right now. I'm aware of sights moving by, sounds moving by, thoughts going by. And there is a sense of like a stable presencing, stable. Once it's there, it's effectively unconditioned in the space of which this is happening. Right? And as we rest more in that, we settle down. We hold what's conditioned more lightly. We let it be. We don't chase it, and we're more and more stabilized here. Yeah, and I think what people describe too is that in the beginning it's as if I am looking at that which is unconditioned, or getting a sense of it, right, and then we start having flashes that which is unconditioned is looking out at me, right? But it's a little further up the path, maybe. But anyway, yeah, right? And then you could take it further into ultimate reality if you're wanting to pop down to that transcendental fourth level, if you will, where, potentially there can be a sense that the universe, which is conditioned, and unfolding since the Big Bang with all kinds of wild, amazing aspects, is in some sense that's meaningful, appearing, occurring inside a larger something or other that is actually or effectively unconditioned. And I think one of the powers of resting in now, again, you can kind of get a feeling for it. what's just before this instant of now, continually, right? Again, not to get weird and trippy about it, but you can start getting a feeling like, wow, this like now is like appearing, but just before now, it's spacious possibility, right? And then boom, now. And I do think, again, operationalizing, reverse engineering, enlightened mind, people are very far along. I think they're really hanging in the freedom and possibility just prior to now. You know, they kind of like they're resting in a way so they can regard what's happening as non-binding. Non-binding. Mm-hmm. Get a feeling for that? And again, it's what we're trying to pinprick. Each time you get a feeling for that, like, or a sense of recognition, it's real, it's valid, it counts. Pinprick hole in that opaque fabric of the ordinary psyche. Kids, little kids, you know, there's a poem, this brief line from Wordsworth, something like, children are born trailing, you know, in the eyes of a child, you can see something infinite. You know, you have that feeling, right? That, like a baby, right? A young child just locks onto you. And you look into their eyes and it's like, zzz, doo, 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 doo. You see through their eyes to something, wow, you know? Wherever you find your intuitions, those count. You know, prick, 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 hole, you know, light shines through. Just to finish maybe, I've so gone over time, I apologize. You know, it's like around the campfire here, it kind of feels kind of sweet. There was last. I think I'd just like to read Merton's poem again. All right? And then we'll just sit quietly for a minute. Okay. Be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you? Whose stillness are you? Sitting for a minute or so. Thank you for your attention and heart. Moving patternings of stillness. Enjoy.